Hey, welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. This episode we have my dear friend, John Hindoff of Radio Lamar fame. He's someone who has been, I think, the voice of endurance racing, of sports car racing for many of us for quite some time. Also fortunate to call him a colleague. I've worked together with him for actually quite a while now. Select occasions, but with growing frequency. Wanted to sit down with Hindy and not so much talk about Radio Le Mans. We'll do that in a future podcast. Wanted to get to know more about him, more about the man behind the voice. And for me, it was quite a bit of fun. Learned that there was a lot of things we have in common. Grew up, obviously, worlds apart. Hindy from England, myself from the West Coast in the United States. Again, for those who are fans of endurance racing, you've probably heard John's voice for hours upon hours upon hours. I just thought it would be perfect timing to get to know the man behind the voice with the 24 Hours of Le Mans coming up here in a couple of weeks. So, here's John Hindoff.
Tell me about young John. Tell me about family. Tell me about the things that aren't motor racing. Because we get that all. We get a million hours of that a week.
And the first thing I would say is it's very, very flattering that people think of me in the terms that you've described me. I am one of the voices of endurance racing because I couldn't do it all myself. And Radio Show Limited and RadioLeMans.com and IMSA Radio and all the other things that we do have been very good to me in terms of me being involved in the sport. But thank you anyway. All of those things happen because we've got a good team around us. The young John, northeast of England, town is Sunderland, hence the rabid following of Sunderland Association Football Club in soccer.
No.
I'm a firm believer that you don't pick your football team, it picks you, and that was my hometown, so red and white are my colours. Born and brought up for most of, in fact, all of my formative years in the northeast of England, Sunderland or its environs. Father, when I was very young, a police constable. He rose to becoming a police inspector in a couple of specialist squads, and then back as a what we would call a shift inspector, so back in the uniform.
Did he have a very structured household? 'Cause I know some folks with either a military background or police background bring that work structure into the home structure, and some go as far away as possible.
Well, I think both my mother and my dearly departed sainted mother, sainted mother, were both fairly well-organized individuals. My father, even now at 82, still has his regime. He's on his own now since the start of the year, or since December anyway. And although he hasn't worked for quite some time now, he has a fairly structured way of life. He had been in the RAF before he was a police officer. His father had been a police officer before him. I never knew my grandfather. Unfortunately, he was killed in a road accident long before I was born, when my dad was just in his early 20s. So my father, who had one sibling, was very much the man of the house early in his years, and I think that influenced him.
Mm.
His sister Judith is quite a lot younger than him, 11 years younger than him. My mother comes from a big family, one of seven surviving children. Her father was a Royal and Merchant Navy, in the Royal and Merchant Navy during the wars and subsequently. Her mother was a stay-at-home mum, where my dad's mum, very unusually, Mary Genevieve, Molly as she was known, was very much in a working female, which in the 20s and 30s was not very well, very much used to. She was a model. She then ran businesses for the Rank organisation, cinemas, and in those days going to the cinema was a bit of a treat, and a lot of cinemas had very good restaurants, and she ran restaurants for the Gaumont concern and then for the rank concern right through into the 60s.
Brilliant.
And I have very, very hazy memories of the late 1960s of being taken to my grandmother's restaurant in Newcastle, which seemed a very long way away in those days, despite it being 13 miles from where we live now, where my mum and dad live now, where my dad lives now. And thinking that was a big day out and a big treat. And in those days, the movie industry, you had, we don't have instant access back then as we have now, of course. So you would have world premieres, you would have national premieres, you would often have regional premieres of big movies.
Interesting.
So some of the photographs I've got of Grandmother Molly with Clint Eastwood and various really big movie stars,
wow,
at Newcastle for a regional premiere of a film in the late 50s right through to the mid and late 60s. Quite remarkable. Fantastic old black and white film. So I came from a background, only child, which can be a curse and a blessing, as every only child who is listening to this will know. Everyone who isn't will go, oh yeah. It does mean that you have a fair weight of expectation,
sure,
of your parents on your shoulders. It also, and I think this is significant for my later years, not by any means a solitary child, but there are times when clearly you are on your own. That doesn't mean you have to be lonely, but it does, I think, mean you grow up with a decent imagination.
Absolutely.
I was very lucky that my mother was most keen. She was a stay-at-home mum, had been a pharmacy assistant at a hospital, and stopped work a couple of years before I came along. She was intent on, she loved reading, loved books, loved literature of all shapes, forms, colours, creeds, and she was intent on passing that along to me. So from a very early age, a ridiculously early age, I was an avid reader, and that again I think has stood me in good stead in my bizarre career path.
Did you have a particular genre that you liked?
Literally from 4 and 5 years old, I had my own library card. I don't remember this because I was too young, but I remember the story of going into, we were very lucky where we lived in those days. There was a public, proper old-fashioned, probably I would think Victorian-built, public library that was actually at the end of the road where we lived. And so we walked to there, mum and I, and went in to get a library card or some library card so we could borrow books. Again, many of you who are electronically literate and are quite young will think, borrowing books. However, that is a thing.
Build a structure
just for books,
and you had to get a card,
correct,
to check them out, and you'd be fined if you didn't get
them
back
in
time.
Absolutely right. You remember that well. As you can imagine, turning up with a 4-year-old curly-haired small boy, the librarians were somewhat less than had less of an appetite to let even their children's books go out. So the story goes, and as I say, I don't remember this, but I remember the story that mum said, pick him a book, anyone from that, it doesn't have to be a baby's book, pick him a book and give it to him and see if he can read it. And of course, having had book put in front of me, opened it and said, would you like me to read this aloud?
Nice.
Small, precocious child. And proceeded to read a couple of paragraphs, and the librarian said, well, okay, then he can obviously read it, he understands it, off he goes. And children's books, obviously, to start with, adventure books. There's a very famous set of books called The Famous Five and The Secret Seven, about children having all kinds of adventures all over the UK. Arthur Ransom had a book called Swallows and Amazons, which was
cookbook.
Yeah,
just kidding.
Indeed, absolutely. Which was set in the British Lake District, which was again about kids sailing water. Not something that we could get involved with, but was sort of adventure books, which were also transported you somewhere.
And that was what I was curious about, because I had stepbrothers growing up. They were a bit older, didn't really ever connect with them, but to your point, while I wasn't an only child, I was often alone and or preferred to be alone, yet was never by myself. always, whether it was something to read or something to do, being able to open a book and go to a place. I might have been wherever I was physically, but my mind was off somewhere else. I think that, I know for me, that shaped my childhood immensely. And then as I grew up, seeing the world in with a lot more color than I think I would have if I hadn't grown up that way.
I think that's a very good point. It informed. I was a voracious reader, and not just children's books. I read biographies, autobiographies. I read a lot of historical books on fairly recent history. So, for example, I remember in my very early teens consuming everything I could about President Kennedy's assassination. It was something, of course, it happened, I was barely alive, 1963, so I was literally a year old when it happened. But I was given as a present very early on a John Kennedy half dollar and a John Kennedy dollar coins, which were clearly commemorative coins. And I had been very moved when I had heard, again, different era, not able just to jump on the computer, but when I'd heard on the radio speeches that John Kennedy had made, President Kennedy had made, about going to the moon, for example, because I was tremendously interested in technology and remember the moon landing very well, even though I was quite young. And I can't remember how, but I had that on a 45-sized floppy disk, not a full acetate record, but a thin plastic one.
I remember that.
It must have come with some publication or something.
Magazine.
Yeah, and I listened to that, heard the passion in President Kennedy's voice and what he was talking about, of course. By this time, it was... I'm not sure the moon landing had happened, but it must have been closed. And to be able to listen to that in context of where the Apollo program was... And knowing and read and having read so much as I could about President Kennedy, his life and his death, the moon landing, and the other thing, of course, is my birthday. And this is another thing that ties me back to the late President Kennedy. I was born on the 28th of October, 1962, a Sunday, and that date will be etched in many people's memory of a certain age. Not because it was the day I was born, but it was the day that the Russian freighters turned back in the Cuban Missile Crisis. So the world was literally on the brink, and the day I was born was the day that it all backed down. And again, that's something else that I've read about because it's part of my lifetime. Only just, but part of my lifetime. So all of that sort of early, late 50s, early 60s, I consumed that fairly... With a huge appetite of finding out what had happened as I'd come into the world. Listening to great orators like John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
That's what I was curious about as well. Did that, obviously as a young boy, you couldn't have known that you would make your living speaking to the world.
Certainly not.
Was that record, or was there a point when... the power of the voice, the strength of the person speaking stuck with you and made an impression?
My early days, in fact, right through my teens as well, was all about radio and the power of books, absolutely. But what was going on in the background wasn't multimedia, it was radio. And whether that was music or voice, and there was a fair bit of both, it was... certainly something that shaped my life. You'll hear people, and I'm one of them, say, I can hear, and I know you are absolutely of this mind, I can hear five bars of a song, and instantly that transports me back to a certain time.
Yeah.
And sometimes even a certain time and a single place in your life. Music has the ability to do that. Good music. Sometimes not good music, just music... can transport you. It can instantly take you back to a place and a time. I find the same about events, about things I've heard, about sport. A lot of it was sporting events, but some of it was news events. Some of the earliest sporting commentaries, play-by-play, I suppose, that that I heard wasn't motorsport at all, although motorsport was part of my life even then. Certainly automotive and cars were. But were boxing commentaries. Big heavyweight fights.
Was this UK based or?
Well, mainly, again, not 24-hour TV and video. Even if they were in the UK, they were probably not on the TV. They were probably on the radio. They were not on the TV. They were on the radio, excuse me. But, you know, fights happened. Most of these big fights happened in Madison Square Garden or Las Vegas or
Absolutely.
Other places. And with the best will in the world, in the late 60s, you weren't going to get live coverage of that. Very rarely. If you were, it was a big treat to be allowed to stay up and watch it. But I remember listening on a tiny... I'm making a sign here with my hands of something about 6 inches long by about 4 inches wide, oblong transistor radio, which was a very early Panasonic, as I remember, plastic case, the usual thing with the little rotary guide on the top that had numbers on it, and another one on the other side for volume, with an earpiece in. Well, not that anybody would recognise it as an earpiece now, but that you plugged in and literally stuck into the darkest recesses of your ear. Try not, middle of the night sometimes, try not to disturb anybody or not to get found out.
Of course.
Listening to the BBC and a chap called Eamon Andrews, who was an Irishman, describing World Championship Boxing. Now, Eamon Andrews is a guy who anyone listening in the UK, of a certain age, will not associate with sport at all, but will associate with his TV career, which was This Is Your Life. And he presented This Is Your Life for decades. But my first, first time I met him was on a radio, listening to him describe a fight from Las Vegas. And again... At that point, there wasn't anything else to gauge it by, but with him sitting ringside, with the crowd noise, with... I'm thinking of it now, and I'm transported back to it. And I had in my head as clear a picture of the left hook, the jab, whatever,
nice.
As anybody who could have seen it on TV would have had. And again, you know, that was... That must have been late 60s, early 70s. So I'd have, you know, been... If it was 72, 73, I'd have just, you know, been getting towards teenage years. But right through my teenage years, listening to sport on the radio was something that we did. On a Sunday, my dad, as I said, was a police officer, so he worked shifts a lot, so he wasn't always around at the weekends. Our weekends sometimes were a Tuesday afternoon. But I can remember... In the summer, listening to Wimbledon on the radio, long before there was colour television. The 1966 World Cup final, I sat with my father, soccer World Cup final, I sat with my father as a very small boy, not yet 4 years old, and watched the World Cup final on a black and white television. And that was one of the few things I can remember my dad being around for. But Wimbledon and all the summer sport, I remember being at the back of the house. We had a walled backyard at that point, and sitting, playing happily with myself. There would have been diecast model cars involved at some stage,
sure.
But on the radio would be whatever sport, whether it was cricket, the test matches, whether it was Wimbledon, whatever. So that was a part of my life, and never really expecting that would be such a big part of my life going through. I always expected I would follow my dad and my grandfather into what I thought was very much the family business and become a policeman. And in fact, applied when I was late teens, early 20s to become a policeman and got right to the end stage and then told to reapply, and I never did. And strangely enough, one of my best friends who works for us with Radio Show Limited now, Joe Bradley, applied at the same time and reapplied when I didn't. He got on and I never bothered following the battle.
I could just see you pulling people over for speeding and, you know, you missed the apex on the last corner there, mate.
Yeah, I'm looking you up, not because you were speeding, but just that your line through that last chicane, sorry, roundabout, was abysmal. And what do you mean you can't heel and toe?
Where does motor racing start to come into your purview? Is that, again, father or family based? Is that something you found on your own?
A bit of both. I never knew my grandfather, as I said, but my dad's dad, John Hindhoff, who was just John, my dad's John Anthony, and gets Tony. My dad's dad was called Jack. Well, John was his given name, but he was always called Jack. Often, however, called Lord John, because my grandfather had an innate ability to live a million-dollar lifestyle on 50 grand a year.
Brilliant.
He was a very clever lad, even in his day. Police officer, as I said, in what was then Sunderland Borough Police Force. I've got pictures of my grandfather with a 4.5 litre Bentley, which was his.
Really?
Yes. Yes, yes.
How did that come about?
Just before the war. Oh, SS Jags, Bentleys. A family story. What happened to the Bentley, Dad? Even this was when I was... I may have just been in my teens, looking at black and white family photos. Is that you, Dad? Small boy on a running board of a car. Yes, that's me. I said, that looks like a Bentley. Yes, that's a 4.5 litre Bentley, son. Whose was that? That was your grandfather's.
What?
Where is it? Tell me it's locked up somewhere, gathering dust.
My inheritance.
Yes, clearly. That was just before the war. I think the war came around, he swapped it for a Studebaker. What? Yes, a doctor took it because he could get the petrol coupons. Your grandfather got the Studebaker, and then he traded that for some... And I'm like, whoa, what happened? And then my father, as I said, would drag out another picture and go... And this was me when I was going down to York with my father to see my mother. My mother was working away in those days, running a restaurant. That's my dad talking. And I go, that's an SS Jaguar. Yeah. Now, in fairness, I'm not sure that was your grandfather's. I think he just had it on long-term loan from someone. And it's like, oh, okay. So I was well-named after my grandfather. My grandfather loved cars and anything mechanical, motorbikes, cars. I've got pictures of him all over the place. Also a very, very good golfer, as was my grandmother. My father was... We didn't have a car when I was growing up, not until probably I was 6 or 7. But I knew cars, and if my dad brought me something home on his way home from work, it was a 64th scale diecast
something
matchbox type car. If I was lucky, a bigger one, a dinky toy size of car, 24th probably, possibly a 43rd, just whatever we could get. And there is a family story, which, whether it's apocryphal or not, of me sitting somewhere, and I can't remember where it would be, but looking down on a street, going, Ford Anglia, Ford Cortina, Vauxhall Weaver, because I couldn't say V's when I was very young, Hillman Hunter, whatever it was, at 6, 7 years old, being able to In fairness, cars were a lot less homogenous than they are now, so you could actually spot the difference between a Ford and a General Motors product. But, that was me. I was just so interested in cars and anything mechanical. One of my mum's brothers, so therefore my uncle, Chris Atkinson, who ended up out in South Africa, he lived around the corner to us, and he... various times he worked down coal mines, but he was a mechanical fitter, a mechanic effectively. And those very different days for us in the UK, those Marshall, owning car ownership was not as prevalent as it has become. And people who had cars were doing all right, unless you were pretty handy and you could keep them on the road yourself.
Sure.
Well, my uncle Chris was like that. And he would think nothing of buying a car and doing it up and flipping it and using the money to buy another one. And he built a carport at the back of his head, back of his house, not even a garage. Just literally, put some railway sleepers up and made sure there was a roof, so a dry area to work on. I've got a feeling he dug a pit as well so he could get under it. But I remember going around there and watching him strip the heads off, Ford side valves and then early cross-flow Ford engines. And regrinding valves and stuff like that. The stuff that you would never think about doing yourself nowadays, you'd send it off to do... Well, in fact, you don't do that anymore because cars are so much more reliable that you don't have to take the head off a car every 15,000 miles and decoke it. take all the rubbish out of the valve seats, because petrol's cleaner, cars are cleaner, and we've advanced so much. But, you know, I remember sitting watching Chris doing that. When my dad's sister Judith got married to Dave Beige, Dave was exactly the same. He was engineering background, so again, got my fingers dirty, knew what to do with spanners. When my dad did get a car, it seemed 5 minutes before I was sitting in the passenger seat and shifting gears for him. So he would dip the clutch and I would shift the gear from second to third, third from fourth, I'd get back down again.
My dad did the same with me.
And then
rebuilt the transmission.
Well, yes. And then obviously as soon as I could reach the pedals. You're not allowed to drive until you're 17 in the UK. That's never changed. But I would have been 13 or 14, private land, wherever we could go. My dad and I would go out often, you know, on a weekend on my dad's day off, and would go out and he'd teach me about clutch control and downshifting and heeling and towing. Because a lot of cars, even then, the sort of cars that we could afford, wouldn't have had all synchro mesh boxes. So double declutching, heeling and towing, all of that stuff was something that you were brought up with. So my relationship with the motor car started quite early. With motor racing, came a little bit later, but not much. The good old BBC still covered Le Mans in those days. I have vague recollections of listening to Le Mans. And Derek Bell was the name that I knew growing up because of his success at Le Mans.
Sure.
Yes, of course, when Jim Clark was killed, that was all over the newspapers. Jackie Stewart and Graham Hill were national heroes. Never off the TV. All the sports personality shows at the end of the season in the UK, Sir Jackie and Graham were always a star turn on that. So in some ways, bizarrely, the motor racing heroes of those times were actually probably more in the public consciousness in those days than they are now. I mean, I dare say somebody can pick out Lewis Hamilton and, you know, those guys. But if you're not really interested in motor racing, I'm not sure there's many people that you would pick out other than that.
There's not a lot of hooks. Yeah.
No. I mean, obviously, we're in the trade, so, you know, different. But it seemed to me that the guys who were... And British drivers were at the very top of the sport. That's another thing. And people like, you know, Paddy Hopkirk and people winning the Monte Carlo Rally and all that sort of thing. That was big, big sports news. Other than England winning the World Cup in 1966, it was the, you know, when Jackie Stewart was winning his world championships in the late 60s and the early 70s. That was big national news on a level that I'm not sure we get nowadays, even for Lewis winning multiple world championships.
Sure.
So you couldn't help but know about these things. And because I was interested in motor racing, and I had a slot car set, and there were old cigar-shaped, effectively Lotuses was what they were, and I was into cars, therefore it made sense for me to learn more about them. But I wasn't like, I mean, Joe Bradley was going off to Croft when he was barely in his teens on his own, sneaking away and going off to Croft. I didn't go to motor races. I seem to remember turning up with Croft in, again, probably my early teens on a day out with my mum and dad. And there wasn't motor racing on. There was some, how would you call it so that people understand it? Like a county fair.
Okay.
So there was old-fashioned steam engines, traction engines there. There was car stands, yeah. There would be people displaying the latest model of cars, but tractors and a fairground, a travelling fairground and stuff like that. And I think that was probably the first time I ever went to a racetrack. And that wasn't the same motor racing. So, you know, yes, I was aware of it. Yes, I was interested in it. I started reading things about Derek Bell. I started reading books about motor racing. But I wasn't subscribing to magazines. I was getting my information in other ways, and it wasn't necessarily up-to-date information. I was looking back at things that had happened in the 60s. I'm beginning to realise I had a fixation about the 60s and when I was very young and what was going on. I've always had the feeling I was possibly born slightly too late.
Well, I mean, I look back, I think most people who have an appreciation of, well, whether it's motor racing, whether it's culture, whether it is technical advancement, whether it's just the human spirit and aspiration, 1960s in many places throughout the world, you know, in whatever capacity, sport, education, science, it's a pretty good time.
Yeah.
Pretty good time.
Agreed. And the other thing about that was, and then what happened, of course, was the advent of Formula One live on television. And people forget how late that actually happened. You know, I was well... I'd have been in my late teens or my early 20s. So you're talking about late 70s, early 80s, before the UK even had every race live. Highlights, yes. And I remember watching sport... I mean, it was a... for me, growing up as a teenager, early teenager, and through my school years, the weekends meant playing some kind of sport for your school on Saturday morning, Saturday afternoon during soccer season. If Sunderland were at home, I'd go to the football in the afternoon and watch the football. If they weren't, you'd go home. Again, you wouldn't be able to watch every game live on the TV, but both the main... We only had two television channels, remember? Both the main channels had sports shows. Stop laughing.
No, I seem to recall having four.
Yeah,
five,
well, there
so.
You go. It was a big thing when we got BBC Two. And in, even BBC Two didn't roll out all across the country at the same time. Obviously, in the North East, we had to wait for it. But I think by the late 60s, early 70s, we would have had three channels. Two BBC and one independent commercial channel. But both the BBC One and the commercial channel, on a Saturday from 12:30 or 1 o'clock in the afternoon through till probably about 6 o'clock, would have a sports show, a live sports show. Now, not everything that was on there would have been covered live, but there would be horse racing, there would be cricket if cricket was on, maybe tennis if tennis was on during the summer. You wouldn't get live football, but sometimes you would get rugby league or rugby union. ITV, the commercial channel, would have wrestling on, believe it or not.
Nice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Live. And also, the BBC, of course, would have motor racing. ITV, the commercial channel, would often have highlights of things. So by about January, February, when nothing else was going on, you might see 45-minute highlights of the previous season's Bathurst 1000K. And I remember watching the 1000K through the 70s and 80s as a 45-minute, 50-minute highlights back in the UK. But the BBC would have live motorsport. Motocross, scrambling, as it was called in those days, motocross as we would call it now. We, during the 70s, I guess, there was an outbreak of a very virulent disease called foot-and-mouth disease, which affects livestock. And back end of the season, the rally, the British Rally, RSC Rally as it became, Wales Rally GB, as I suppose it still is now on the World Rally Championship calendar. And bear in mind, from the North East, there was a lot of rallying going on because we were a spit away from Kielder Forest.
Of course.
Couldn't have the rally because you couldn't move around. So to fill the hole, Rallycross was invented. And the little circuit at Liddon Hill hosted the first rallycross meeting, and all these rally cars couldn't do anything else, and people like Roger Clark turned up to do this bizarre mix of tarmac and dirt and sideways and racing, and wow,
I fell in love with it the first time I saw it.
Immense sport. And of course that happened up at Croft when Croft was closed as a race circuit. It was opened as a rallycross venue. And, you know, Joe Bradley and I, who, even before we knew each other properly, we knew each other from going, oh, there's that lad who I know who goes to rallycross and watches the rallycross. And I still remember the Internations Cup in the 80s with all the Group B rally cars that had been outlawed. 8 and 10 off a grid with S4s, RS2000s, even RS2000 Evos were 10 a penny.
Remember Martin Shanker was...
Martin Shanker, Demi Mavropoulos in the Sport 2 Quattro, Nitty Markey, Ali Markey, all of those guys, Tony Proctor, whose son, of course, races now, and who I've raced with and against. You know, that was the big thing, and that was on a Saturday afternoon. So motorsport, frankly, if it had Wales, I mean, you know what we've said, if they have Wales and keep score, we'll talk about it. Well, that's because there was an eclectic mix on those Saturday afternoon shows.
What you grew up with.
Much like the wild, wide world of sports that you guys had, which might have one week, might have motorcycle racing on, the next week it might have formula racing on, the next week it would have endurance racing on.
And that was the fun part, We didn't have consistency. We didn't have volume. There were not 5, 10, 15 championships to follow, but there was always something interesting. You didn't know what it was, but it was going to be something quite interesting. Jim McKay talking about it or whomever. And yeah, for me, it was always a bit of a mystery, but fun. And then as the 80s came in and cable television in America started to grow, it's funny. I'd grown up at my father's shop. I'd always worked there. When you're a son working for your father, at least at that age, what that means is you do work. You get no money, but it's called working. My first motivation to get a real job, a paying job, was so that I could afford cable. Because TNN and a variety of cable channels were showing IMSA races and Formula One on ESPN and a variety of things that we didn't have at home. My father was quite thankful that I went and got a real job so I could pay for it while still fairly young in my teens. But I did that simply because I wanted more motor racing. It wasn't on broadcast television, and the only way to do it was to get cable.
But the interesting thing about that was that eclectic nature of what was on broadcast television in those formative years for me meant that I never became a touring car fan or a Formula One fan or a bike fan. I became a motorsport fan.
Yeah, absolutely.
I became a motorsport fan with all of the implications that that big word implies. And whilst, obviously, we're sitting here talking now because of my undoubted affection for endurance racing and being involved with that side of the sport has done great things for me. And it's great. But I'm still a motorsport fan. And I'm still... And there are people who think that I hate Formula 1. I don't hate Formula 1. I despair for Formula 1 at the moment, but I still watch every Formula 1 race I can. Now, there was a time when I ran my life around Formula 1.
Of course.
I don't do that now. There's several good reasons for that, because quite often I don't have the opportunity. For example, where we are sitting talking about this at the weekend, I'm ready to do a sports car race, and there will be a Formula 1 race this weekend, and I can't do both. So there's some good reasons for that. But if I'm not working, I will watch it live. If I can't, I'll watch highlights. And I still am, you know, as you know from listening to us and what we do with the rest of Radio Show Limited, it's not as if we ignore the other forms of motorsport, whether it's IndyCar. I've got a much finer appreciation of stock car racing and NASCAR since in the last 16, 17 years, since I've come to the States and I've driven around some of the ovals and I've sat in stock cars and I've driven ARCA cars back in the UK through my association and working at Rockingham Motor Speedway. My knowledge and thirst for knowledge for motorsport has not dimmed one iota from that 8, 9, 10, 15, 18-year-old kid through my formative years. I want to find out more. I want to know more. I'm going to do Bathurst a few years ago, where there's a bit of a family connection because a relatively distant cousin, but a cousin of ours, Bruce Hindhoff, raced there, won the race in his class with a tiny little Toyota, 1,000cc Toyota, then built the engines for Brocky when Brocky was having a falling out with the Holden factory and won with a Turana with the Hindhoff name on it with Brocky in, I think, 74. You know, all of those things, as I go to new places and discover new things about motorsport and different forms of motorsport, Racer Champions, when I've been involved, up until last year, I'd been involved with Racer Champions for 12 straight seasons. And the guys that I met there from other forms of motorsport, from other parts of the world, went out to, you know, all sorts of weird and wonderful places and found out how motorsport is seen by other cultures. Being able to go to Japan with WEC and seeing how motorsport affects, particularly endurance motorsport, is so close to the national psyche and consciousness. All of those things, I have a voracious appetite. And drag racing, I mean, I've been to NHRA over here in the States. By the same token, we've been to 8th mile oval events that's $5 to get in and a couple of dollars for a beer and a couple of dollars for a hot dog.
And the most fun you'll have.
Absolutely. And I want to learn about it. I want to stand with people who know what they're talking about. And we talk to them. I'm despite having a fairly solitary childhood in some ways, I'm still quite a social person, and I like talking to people. And so what's going on here? And how does that work? And now, in fairness, most people will tell you that's not just with motorsport. Whether it's American football or baseball or other sports, there's not many sports that I won't watch. And if I'm going to watch a sport, I want to know about it.
Of course.
I want to understand the rules. I want to understand why that's a foul play. Why you're not allowed to do that? Oh, okay, fine. So you're not allowed to jump until the nose tackle snatches the ball. Oh, okay, the centre rather. Snaps the ball. Okay, fine. So that was offside, was it? Oh, that's a false start. Okay, I see. I understand. And that sort of thing takes you into the parts of the sport that I'm interested in, which is the detail.
It's the curiosity, and as I grow older and learn more, understand my habits more, I realize that the folks that I find interesting or the folks that I consider to be friends or want to spend my time with, they have a lifelong curiosity. That's a defining pattern of their personality. Maybe not the center of their personality, but a curiosity. And that might, to those who have that curiosity, what I just said might sound like, well, duh, Pruitt. But I do find that those who I have very little time for, or those who bore me to death, are the ones who know everything, or aren't interested to lift the rock and see what's under and figure out why it's under instead of on top. So again, it's not saying one's better than the other. I just know that for me, that has been my lifelong sensibility as well, very much because of my father. Hey, don't just accept it.
That's
why?
Right.
Why? Why should be one of the most commonly spoken words? And for me, at least, that's been true.
My father always used to. My father gave me a lot of very sage advice, most of which, of course. But when you get it, you're far too green or have the arrogance of youth to understand and actually action. As you get older, you realise what great advice that was, and damn, I wish I'd listened to some of it more and actioned it more. But as I said, my dad was a cop. And a couple of things about my dad. My dad was ambitious. He pushed hard. He took his exams and spent a lot of time being a cop and didn't get promoted to be a sergeant. But he said, listen, if I finish my 30 years as a cop, I started walking around with no radio, with just a whistle. British cops don't carry guns. They used to carry a stick and a pair of handcuffs, if you were lucky. He said, I started off walking around feeling doors, trying doors of shops to make sure the premises were secure.
Hmm.
He says, if I end my career doing that, I'm going to make sure I'm the best door feeler upper that the police force has ever seen. Because I'm going to put my heart and soul into that and make sure I do a 100% decent job of what I can do. There's no point in doing anything if you're not going to give of your best. And the other thing that he said was, no matter what you do, no matter how boring, how uninteresting, if you're sitting pulling a lever down, squashing something into a small shape every day, ask yourself the question, where did that piece of metal come from before it got to me, and where does it go after it leaves me? And those were two things that kind of must have got stuck in there.
Sure.
I'm not sure I actioned them quite enough, but certainly the one about the curiosity of, you know, my early working years were in an environment which is completely different to motorsport, and I never thought I'd be involved in motorsport. I left school and went to work in a bank, and the only reason I went to work in a bank was because one of my best friends at school worked in a bank, and I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew I didn't want to stay on at school or go to college or university.
Little did you know, you decided to take that job that Tom Christensen left behind.
Yeah,
see?
Yeah, exactly so. And I went and worked in a bank, and within about 21 days of work, and I realised I'd made a hideous mistake. But in those days, I wasn't sure that you were meant to enjoy your work.
Yeah.
You went to work, you earned money, you came home. I was still living at home.
Duty
I was, what, 17? 17, 16, and I don't think I was 17 when I started working in the bank. And I lasted it for 2.5 years before I realised I couldn't do it anymore. And I went off and did a host of weird and wonderful things, including working as a security guard, working in local government, pushing papers around. I literally had a job where when people say, I know what day it is because that piece of paper is on my desk. I had that job.
Wow.
Where at 2:30 on a Tuesday afternoon, a certain set of papers were put on my desk. And on Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock, there'd be a different set of papers on my desk that I had to process. Did all that. And again, my father, bless him, he said to me, show me a guy who enjoys his job, and I'll show you a guy who never works a day in his life. And as a, you know,
amen.
As a know-it-all late teenager or only 20-something, I'm like, what? Yeah. What does that mean? Yeah, you're talking in riddles, father.
Too young to process it.
But he's absolutely right. Yeah. He's absolutely right. And I know now, I mean, what I do now, I know people would give important parts of their anatomy without any anaesthetic to do what you and I do now. Never mind get paid for it as well, by the way. I never even processed what my dad was saying at that point. And sure, it's still work, and everybody bitches about work now and again, but I could be doing a hell of a lot less interesting things, and I pretty much don't know what my day is going to bring. And that goes back to that curiosity thing. I don't want it set out in front of me. And one of the great things about broadcasting, particularly live broadcasting, is that even if you know when it starts and it finishes, you don't know what's going to fill in the middle. Nobody's writing you a script, and you've just got to make the best out of what's there. I find that extraordinarily cathartic in some respects and exciting in others, and hellishly scary in others. And it's still scary, and I think it still should be scary. But in those days, as I say, 20-year-old, 17, 18, 19, after something, was I 19, 20 when I left the bank? Not even that, maybe. You know, I was as green as grass.
It's funny you mentioned that about the curiosity as it applies to the race. We're sitting here at Sebring. I'm coming in from the St. Petersburg IndyCar race, season opening IndyCar race. I've had a lot of people ask, how was it? How was the weekend? And every answer I've given has been more along the lines of, it was good, the race itself wasn't great.
No.
Why? Was much of a story.
Yeah.
And so that, for me, I think like you, here we have 12 hours of a tale.
Mm-hmm.
That was 2 hours or so. The quality of the competition, the unexpected things that happen. I love the racing, I love the cars, the people, all of these things, just the passion side as a fan, not the professional. But for me, the quality of a race is the quality of the story, which is, I don't know if that's a weird way to look at it or not, but that is how I look at it. When I think about St. Petersburg, and I think about what happened between the green flag and the checkered flag, there were passes, there were crashes. Overall, that tale wasn't that interesting to me, though. And so even though someone won, and maybe to another person, they would get excited because their favorite driver won.
Yeah. Oh,
that's great. Again, we all take different things.
People will say to me, that's a superb point. And people will say to me, well, it's much easier because your races are longer. Hey, I started off doing kart races at 10 and 12 laps, and you still had a story. You had a start, a middle, and an end. And you have to tell that story, whether it's on the PA to one man and his dog, and trust me, I've done that one.
The dog said thank you, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, always one of my biggest fans. Or it's a 24-hour race. There is a developing story, and I think one of the things I learned, and I was very fortunate to be influenced by the people I was influenced by and have the life experience of listening to the broadcasts that I was interested in. And then after, trying to think how many years, probably a better part of a decade. I should say broadcasting, by the way, was, unbeknownst to me, was in the family genes, because when my father was in the RAF, he ran the radio station at both the training camp that he was at and when he was on active duty in the Middle East. And never told me, by the way, until relatively recently. I mean, within the last 10 years.
By the way, kid, you're not the first.
Yeah, I mean, ridiculous. And my first broadcasting experience was because I left school when a lot of my friends stayed on to do higher education. I was left with A, some time, and B, a lot of my friends had moved away.
Yeah.
I blew out a cartilage playing too much football. My ambitions were, in no particular order, obviously something to do with cars, so obviously desperate to be a racing driver. Play football for England and Sunderland. Be a policeman, like my father and my grandfather. And none of those should be anywhere on the horizon for the young Hindhoff. And I played quite a bit of football to a decent standard, to a obviously played for the school, played for the town and the county, and did athletics for the town and county as well. Well, not though you'd believe that looking at me now, but 800 metres a mile and 5 or 10,000 metres cross country, particularly running, was I could do that all day. Never a decent sprinter, and I blew my knee out when I was. I was still at school, so 15, 16 maybe. Last year at school, blew my cartilages out and went in to get my knee done. I just left school, actually. And there was my football career gone, because I could still play, but I couldn't do the training. I certainly couldn't do two or three games a week on heavy, muddy grounds. But whilst I was in hospital, I heard hospital radio. And the hospital radio had commentary of the football game from Sunderland, from the old Roker Park. And so when I got myself back up and running, I must have just left school, actually, I went down, presented myself and said, hey, I was in hospital a few weeks ago, listened to you, thought it was great, because the other thing, I always wanted to be a music DJ. Radio 1 in the UK, that's the biggest radio station, I could do that.
Sure.
It's good. It's play records and talk, how hard can it be? And if only you could see my face now. And walked in, and there was a guy called Graham Anderson, I'll never forget it. He said, so what do you do? And I said, you know, told him what I was doing. And you know, he said, right, you read a script? Yeah. He said, sit down over there, across from a microphone, not dissimilar in shape and size to what we're looking at now, although it was mounted the other way around on one of those big sort of booms that has articulation in all sorts of places. And I put a set of headphones on, sat there, and I'm sitting with the script, and the red light on, and a voice of me says, cue. And he goes, I went, so it's 9 o'clock on Hospital Radio Sunderland at the moment, and that means it's time for Marshall Pruitt and request time. You know, what was that? And he said, great, half an hour later, I'm back again. So here's the news headlines, and we'll be back with, you know, the country music programme with Dave Miggins in a minute, but here's the news headlines, blah, blah, blah. And that was my, I mean, literally, talk about throwing in at the deep end. So he said, yeah, so you, okay. Right, I want you to think about an idea for a programme. Build yourself a programme, and then pick some music tracks, and come back next week, and we'll see if you're any good. And that's what I did. And I did what you would call light rock, I suppose, because that's the music I was into. So you're talking about a bit of Eagles, a bit of Dire Straits. I remember having the CDs of Dire Straits very early on. Wow. We got them sent to us. Yeah, we tried out a Philips CD player when they first came out, because it was vinyl, of course, when we first started. Sticks. Yes. You know, stadium bands and stuff like that. I mean, that's certainly what we graduated on to.
Killing people softly.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And all of that sort of stuff. And put a show together and, yeah, okay, fine. And they did half an hour to start with, then it became an hour. Then I took... You heard what I said about I need to know stuff. Then I said, I need to be if I'm going to be involved with this, I need to be involved with this. How's the thing run? We've got a committee. We've got... Right, okay. Never had any money, so we put some kit together and went out and did PA jobs, mobile discos, firework displays, local fetes. I mean, literally, christenings, weddings, bar mitzvahs. If we could make money out of it for the charity, we made money out of it.
That was a great grind, though, to learn from.
It was a brilliant, brilliant basic grounding.
Obscure things,
yeah.
But self-taught, self... Go, figure it out.
Yeah, and literally we did everything. And I got a little bit of technical knowledge out of that. Some of the guys that were there were really, really talented. I learned how to edit tape, which was cutting tape in those days with razor blades and China graph pencils, quarter-inch tape, and learned about how a radio station worked, learned about the finances, ended up as a committee member, had very many happy years working with those guys. And it was quite a long time. I mean, that would have been probably 5 or 10 years I was involved with that, even when I was doing other stuff as well. And went out and did gigs in front of people and put records, and was a mobile disco for the hospital radio, to raise money for the hospital radio. Subsequently went on and did a bit of that for myself, then worked in clubs and pubs and nightclubs and played records and mixed records and all of that sort of stuff. But that's what got me started. And that's what got me to realise that, oh, this is quite interesting. But I never saw it as a job or a career path at that point. I was still always having to do something else.
What has it been like for you? What was that point in your motor racing commentating career when you realized, aha, my voice does more than just go out and fall into people's ears?
Yeah.
This is something that can piss people off, can have them calling advertisers or whoever saying, fire that hind off guy right now, or my advertising budget's gone. When did the weight or severity or implications of your words, when did those that become visited upon you? Because I know it's something you keep in the back of your mind.
Well, yeah.
And with everything I say, I could be ending my career. I could be losing the money to pay the mortgage.
Here's the interesting thing about that. And there is almost a defining moment. There's certainly one of a number of defining moments that I can tell you about exactly. But also, what I would say is there are far fewer of those events than people would think, and I'll tell you why I think that is in a moment. But in terms of this is what happens: kart meeting, as in go kart meeting. Joe Bradley and I sitting on the top of a double decker bus at a very wet and windy kart circuit on Teesside in the northeast of England on a Sunday afternoon, having watched what could only be described as a crash fest of a heat of karting. It wasn't even a final. It was a heat of 100 Britain karting. So two-stroke karts, no gears, on a very well-designed and fast circuit, but karts off everywhere. At the end of the heat, we see one of the driver's fathers walking in what can only be described then and now, as I see it in my mind's eye, an extremely purposeful way towards the clerk of the course, who was standing getting ready for to grid up the next heat. And in his hand was £50. And £50 was the amount of money that you had to put down in those days to register a protest to the clerk of the course. So we're sitting up, we see this, we've got microphones, and Joe and I said, "Ooh, that's interesting. There's Dave Miggins' dad walking over to Bob Smith, who's the clerk of the course, and well, that looks like a protest to me, Joe." "Absolutely, John. He's got 50 quid in his hand. That's a protest. So the result of that last heat, we're going to have to say is provisional, as we always do, but looks like there's a protest coming." 5 minutes later, the clerk of the course stomps up to the top deck of the bus. "Shall we? Yes, how can we help you?" "Turn off the microphones." "Oh, you can't be saying that. That's between me and him. That's what..." And Joe Bradley turned around and coined one of the phrases that's been used many times since. He said, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, hang on a minute. We're just spectators with microphones." Number one, that was a brilliant and brilliantly simple way of describing what a play-by-play commentator does.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you so much, Joe Bradley. But secondly, I sat there and went, "Ah, actions and words can have consequences. Of course they
can. People are listening."
Yes. And whether that is drivers' families when there's been a big accident, and one of the things I'm always, always drumming into people who come and work for us is that we are community radio for our sport. the paddock, when we talk blithely about the paddock and the paddock family, that's not a place. It's not one place. It really is a community. And it might be somebody listening on the other side of the world who hears that their husband, son, significant other, or just friend has gone off and had a big crash. And you have to remember that every time you open your mouth when you're talking about things like that. I said before I started to answer this question that there are far fewer of those nasty phone calls than people would ever think. Because all I've ever done, and I think people who know me know this, is called it the way I see it.
Hmm.
Now, with the hindsight sometimes, you might say something different. We don't have the benefit of hindsight. It's there, it's in and of the moment. I've often apologised immediately when you get to see a replay. Now that we're working with TV, in the early days when there was no replays, sorry guys, I can only call it the way I see it. But when you see a replay, I can often say, oh, hang on a minute. Oh no. Sorry, whoever, I've done you a disservice there. You were right up on the curb. You had nowhere to go. It wasn't your fault. The guy turned in on you. And I think that most people, there have been one or two significant exceptions to this, but only literally one or two. But I think most people who take the time to know me or listen to the body of work that we've amassed, and not just me, all of us that do this job, there are very few people who go out deliberately to say something that is going to harm someone or to upset someone or to stymie someone's career.
Sure.
Very few. Very few. And I'll defend all my broadcast colleagues when I say that, whether it's TV, radio, online, whatever. And all you can do is try and be honest. In some ways, I'm paid to have an opinion, and my wife will tell you I'm not short of them.
Hmm.
But I can only call it the way I see it. And I've often refused to be shaken by things, even afterwards, if other evidence hasn't been placed before me. And the incident that I can think of most recently still is the P2 battle at Fuji in the WEC last year. I saw a driver drive into the back of the championship rival of his teammate and take him out of the championship. That's what I saw. And what I'd seen beforehand leading up to that and what I saw at the time, that was what I saw. And whatever anybody thinks, even if you look at a very bizarre judgment from the stewards, I was right that I saw that, because he wasn't brake tested. He did nail him. He did knock the car out of the championship. And, all right, it's not always as cut and dried as that, but all I can do is say it how I say it. And drivers have said to me, the biggest and the best and the least known of any have often said to me, and I take this as a huge compliment, if I go up to a driver and say, man, that was a great drive today, they never take that as a blithe comment, because they know that I'll be the one going to them and say, you didn't have the best day in the office today, did you, fella? What were you thinking? What were you thinking?
You put the helmet on backwards again, didn't you?
Because I try to be that honest. I'm easy to find. I'm a big, ugly guy who doesn't hide from anything. And
tell me about it.
You've got, well, I think when you pick up a microphone, and some people, or a keyboard, and some people forget this in our trade, in reporting. I report live. I don't always have, and anybody who does my job doesn't always have the comfort blanket of being able to sit and think about it for 20 minutes before they put pen to paper. We have to do it right there, right then. But even if you are writing it down, you've got to remember that your words do have consequences, but there's got to be a certain truth in what you do. And it's got to be a truth that you believe in, or otherwise what you're doing the job for. But also, you've got to accept that some people are going to come and disagree with you, and you've got to be prepared to either be swayed by their arguments or stand your ground. And saying things like, oh, well, haters are going to hate, a few catchphrases that I want to come up now, which I despise. Haters are going to hate. Well, we'll have to agree to disagree. I'm allowed to have my opinion. right, you are allowed to have your opinion, but when you're stating something that is incorrect factually, then expect someone to come and point that out to you. And that's the sort of thing that I, unfortunately, some people in the trade don't get. You're putting yourself out there to be shot down. If you're going to say something stupid, if you are going to say something stupid, then beware, because it's easy enough nowadays for that to be played back a bazillion times. Now, do I get things wrong? Does anybody who calls live sporting events get things wrong? Absolutely. Come on, poor guy who announced the wrong winner of the beauty pageant. And that's not like 16 cars going into a corner at the same time and you pick the wrong red one. You know, it happens. Get over it, move on. And I will defend to my last dying breath anybody who does live sporting commentary in any sporting arena that you are going to make mistakes. But you've got to own that and say that's the way it's going to be. Generally speaking, is there truth in what you do? Is there truth in what you believe in? Whether it's the written word, whether it's the spoken word. And make yourself available for people to talk to you about it. And I think if you do that and you have an honesty and try and find out what it's like to be on the other end of it. That's why I still drive racing cars when I can. Not as much as I would like to, but I'm an international FIA International C license holder now. And if I put in for my grading, by the way, I'll be a very good bronze. Very good bronze. Dead cheap. But why do I go out and race? Because I think I'm going to be a racing driver. No, not at all. It informs what I do. Why do I drive fast cars when I'm racing circuits? When somebody says, do you want to drive the pace car? Do you want to drive one of the display cars? Yes, absolutely I do. Because I want to be able to say, well, there's a very tricky change of camber just on the exit of that corner. And so that looks like he's driven straight off there, but he's got half a car wide and then he's gone off. You can hit that curb, you can't hit that curb. If you hit that curb on the inside, it'll throw you out. All of these things are things that enrich my commentary, which means that you bring people along for the ride with you. You put them somewhere. You're adding to something. You're adding to your knowledge base. We're back to that curiosity again, aren't we?
Say.
Oddly enough.
Curious job.
Very cathartic. Very cathartic. And I think just to finish off that, I've been very lucky in that when I have gone to professional broadcasting and been involved with it at whatever level, and remember, I was a professional broadcaster. I worked for Radio Le Mans. I'd done broadcasting. I became a professional broadcaster with the BBC, who took me apart and put me back together again. They taught me about news. They taught me about putting things back together. And it's like, you know, when you've been driving, you pick up bad habits and then somebody teaches you just how to refine your skills. That's a wonderful thing, because you didn't know you knew what you knew. And when I went and worked for the BBC, I almost felt, and whisper this, that I should have been paying them for what I learned from it. Mm. But those are the building blocks of broadcasting that you never forget. So, you know, in British advertising, we have a thing, is it legal, decent, honest and truthful? And the BBC, the absolute precepts of that the BBC were built on, the cornerstones, were inform, entertain, educate. And if you keep those things, one from commercial side of broadcasting, and bear in mind I did work in advertising for a while, and the public service broadcasting of the BBC, that even in your most excited moments, of which I know many people will say there are too many of mine. I'm sorry in some respects about
I've
that.
I've never heard that.
I just can't control my enthusiasm sometimes. But when I say something, I honestly believe it and I will defend it at the time. And if somebody comes back and said, you said such and such, I'll say, no, I didn't say that. This is what I said, because I know what I've said. And nowadays you can always pull the archive anyway. And if I think somebody has driven like a fool, I will say that. If I think someone has been, it's very difficult to prove intent, of course, but if I think someone has done something deliberately, I will say that. If I do something, and quite often you will hear me say, people will say, you said I should have my license endorsed. And I would say, no, what I actually said was, if I'd done that in a club race in the UK, I would expect my license to be endorsed. And that's a different thing.
Of course.
Does it add up to the same thing? Possibly. But I'm not saying, hey, Chief Steward, you go and endorse Marshall Pruitt's license. What I'm saying is that kind of driving, I have said this before, that kind of driving you wouldn't get away with in iRacing, never mind real racing. And so people hear different things. So what you've got to be prepared to do is say, yes, I hear what you're saying, but have you actually listened to what I said? And when people do, normally, they come back to me and say, yeah, all right. And I think if you keep those building blocks that I talked about in your mind, and if you, I mean, just be fair. Just be fair and truthful. And then those incidents of people wanting to burn your house down are few and far between. When I say those things, what I'm trying to do is explain to the viewer or listener how good or bad I think that incident, that overtake, that whatever is I've just seen. And to just put that on a scale of 1 to 10 might not be enough. If it is something that is so blindingly, obviously bad, then I want to describe that as that and do it in a way that people are going to understand. And we have a very savvy audience for what we do. Probably in the endurance racing part of the sport, I would say that our audience is the best in terms of being informed and immersed in any sport.
It's a requirement. If you are a passionate, if you're an avid follower or fan of sports car racing, there's no such thing as a casual fan. If so, you're missing almost everything.
And I want to let those people know, if it's super good, I remember here, Emmanuel Pirro, Dresden Racing, I'm not sure it was two laps into the race, down into the hairpin, came from so far back, he was in a different zip code.
Past the world.
And he must have passed 127 cars going into it. And I remember when we saw that on replay saying to Jeremy Shaw, that's it, hold the phones, stop taking entries, that is the overtake of the season right now. And Emmanuel Pirro always reminds me of that, and I'm sure he's got that piece of audio somewhere. But that, I wanted to place that in people's consciousness and just not say, wow, that was a fantastic overtake. Because next week I might say, well, that was a fantastic overtake. So how good was that overtake? That was the best overtake you're going to see all season, and this is the first race of the season. So don't expect to see anything better than that. Isn't that much more, doesn't that much more give an understanding to the person who's watching or listening to that, that, oh, that was kind of an okay overtake?
Golf clap. Nice, Emanuele.
Yeah. And so if I do that for positive things, I've got to be allowed to do that for negative things as well. So to say, that is possibly one of the most stupid things I've ever seen on a racing circuit. That, given I've seen a lot of stupid things on a race circuit, and many people know that, then you're kind of placing that in the hierarchy of stupidity. And that's all I'm trying to do. And some people will get upset. Some people might take exception to it. But you know what? There's very few people. People know that I called Anthony Davidson out for driving not very well at Le Mans 1 year. And Anthony and I are firm friends because we sat down and talked about that. And we came at it from two different ways. He ended up being a contributor to our programme. He's ended up working with me. I have a great relationship with him. And we understood. Did I change my opinion of what he did and particularly what he said in interview? Absolutely not. Did he change his opinion? Probably not either. But that doesn't mean we can't come at that from two angles and say, and when he said, this is what you said, I said, no, that's not what I said. I said, you drove, there was a difference of opinion over a word. And I said, you drove like a complete knob. That's what I said. And he challenged that and we went through, and I went through a few incidences, and Ant and I have become firm friends over that. Not over that incident, but that's what brought us together. And he's a commentator now. He does Formula One. So he understands now far better than he ever did about why you've got to be able to say stuff. And then, it's not that I don't worry. Of course I worry. But I have far more consideration about a driver having a crash than I think about describing a good or a bad thing. Because there you're playing with other people's emotions. And quite often I say things that I don't remember. I remember Kelly McNish telling me that when Alan rolled the car at Le Mans, when he got out of the car, I said, don't worry, Kelly, he's out of the car. He's got out of the car on his own. I can't remember saying that. But I was convinced I'd seen a very good friend of mine being seriously injured or worse than that. And Kelly was running to the pit at the time with a radio flapping, and one of the girls that was with her said, oh, Hindhoff said, he's out of the car, he's fine. And he's mentioned your name, so it's going to be all right. And that's when you realise the weight that your words have, more than the other things. When I had to read the official notification from the ACO by Alan Simonson, that's when you realise. Because there was nothing else to say other than the words on the paper. And that, when you have to do that, that's when you understand the gravity of the job that you do. When everything's wine and roses and it's all sweetness and light, being a commentator is an easy thing to do because it's all in front of you. Say what you see. When it's all gone to rat poo, and whether it's because you're filling for 25 minutes because there's a red flag and somebody's laying down new concrete, as happened here a few years ago, or whether it's because the ultimate sacrifice is being made by somebody who you know, then that is a different story altogether. And that's what's, I think, that's what I get paid for. The hard times, not the easy times.
John Hindhoff, big man with a big heart. I think that comes across whenever he is sharing his views, expertise, or commentary. Thanks for listening in. Check out more podcasts and other content at marshallpruitt.com.